This is the Waters and Harvey Show. I'm Darren Waters.
And I'm Marcus Harvey.
What does it mean to be a trailblazer? Being the first, setting a path for others to follow. We're going to explore these questions on today's show. Marcus and I will be back in a moment. Again, this is the Waters and Harvey Show. I'm Darren Waters. Very glad to have you all join us again here in the audience as usual. And as always, I am glad to be accompanied by my brother, Dr. Marcus Harvey. Marcus, once again, here we are. How are you, brother?
Nice to be here. I'm doing well. Good. How are you?
I am doing really good. Excited about this particular conversation because we have a very, very special guest with us today. You know, we're talking about what does it mean to be a trailblazer? And there's still people who are blazing trails for many of us to follow. And I think that this is an important role that many people play. And the person we're going to talk about today, you know, is definitely a trailblazer.
Yeah, and I think it's important to sort of resurrect, if I can use that term, to resurrect the idea of the trailblazer, because it seems to me that increasingly, you know, we live in a society that values conformity over innovation and originality. So I think this is a very timely conversation
to have. It is. And sometimes to be a trailblazer, you have to dare to go in a different direction. Mm-hmm. And Marcus here, it makes me remember a quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson. He once said when he was speaking to an audience of graduates, and I don't remember the exact university where he said this, but he is quoted as saying, "Do not go where the path may lead." He said, "But go instead where there is no path, and leave a trail." And the one thing that I can say about our guest today, that he's someone who has done this, and our guest today, just to not to keep you all in the dark about who we're going to be talking about, because we keep talking about our guests today, is Buncombe County Commissioner Alfred J. Whitesides. Mm. And certainly he has been one of the people who has been taking Emerson's challenge to blaze new path and to chart new paths.
Yeah, and it's important also to realize that, you know, that and we've talked about trailblazers on this show before, mm-hmm. one of whom is Carter G. Woodson.
That's right.
We talked about the courage, just the sheer courage and the vision that it requires to chart a new path, as Emerson, that great philosopher and poet, put it.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, in talking about Woodson again, since you brought him up here, you know, he's one of our favorite historians to talk about. And we also talk about, you know, John Hope Franklin, W.E.B. Du Bois, some of these guys who really blazed trails in the late 19th and early 20th century. And Woodson is one of those guys who, you know, was very self-sacrificing too, to do the work that he did. And I believe that that is something that can be said about Mr. Whiteside's life. He's been very self-sacrificing in the things that he's been willing to do.
And I think also, you know, we've been talking in recent shows about the history of this particular region, this particular part of the state. And I think it'll be intriguing to identify trailblazers in our region
That's right.
And I think Mr. Whiteside.
That's right. And I think that he'll be able to point us to who some of those people are, because I've had many conversations with him before. And the one thing that I admire about him so much is that he is always talking about the shoulders that he stands on, the people who came before him, and understanding that. And I think that that is a message for the younger generation, and even our generation, to know and to hear and to develop an appreciation for. So when we come back in just a minute, Marcus and I want to go into a conversation with Commissioner Alfred J. Whitesides. Again, for those of you who are just joining us, this is the Waters and Harvey Show, and we're talking with Mr. Alfred J. Whitesides today. We're talking about the subject of trailblazers. What does it mean to be a trailblazer? That is our central focus here. And as noted in the last segment, our guest is Mr. Alfred J. Whitesides, who is now serving as a Buncombe County Commissioner. And I think it's important to highlight the fact that he is the first African-American in the history of this county to serve in that role. And so he has been a trailblazer really on on a host of different levels here in Asheville, in Buncombe County, in this region of our state, and I would even argue throughout the state of North Carolina. And so we are pleased and very honored to have Mr. Alfred J. Whitesides, Buncombe County Commissioner, in here today in the studio to have a conversation about his background, his life. Welcome to the
welcome,
show.
Welcome,
Mr. Whiteside.
Oh, man, it's a pleasure being here with you.
Yeah. And we know that you are a very busy man. Just a few nights ago, I had the opportunity to witness you sitting up there in your chair on the county commission, and I believe that it was a very long county commission meeting.
I didn't get home until after midnight.
And the one thing I wanted, as a citizen in this county and in the state, you know, I want to say, I really appreciate the fact that you're willing to do that, because I was thinking this is not something that I would look forward to. So welcome in here. And I tell you, know, we're talking about being trailblazer, and I think it is very appropriate for us to describe you as a trailblazer, because you've been blazing trails here. You and I've had a number of conversations before. I'll just let our audience know that in some ways I feel like Mr. Whiteside is an extension of my parents, because he and my parents, they kind of grew up here in the area together. So
sure,
whenever Mr. Whiteside calls me to ask me to do something, I feel that it is the equivalent of my parents telling me to do something, so it has to be done.
You're under direct obligation at this
point. That's right. So, but one thing that I wanted to do, because I knew that this would be an interesting conversation, a good conversation for our listeners to hear, but I wanted to start, Commissioner Whiteside, with your childhood in your early years here in the region. I mean, one of the things that for me, having grown up here as well and then leaving in 1985, and still, you know, in the work that I'm still doing here in the field of history, is trying to get people to recognize that African Americans do have a history in this region. And you're one of those people. And I have enjoyed hearing your story, and would like to just kind of begin there, because the two people that you talk the most about when you're talking about your early period are your mother and father and the influence that they had on you. Could you just tell us a little bit about your relationship with your parents early on?
Yeah. Well, to start with, I'm the fifth generation of my – no, I'm sorry, fourth. Generation of my family in the area, my daughters who live here now, the fifth, and my grandsons are the sixth generation of our family. So we've been around for a while. For me, I grew up in an area they call Stumptown, which was off Pearson Drive, Gray Street. Grew up there with mom, dad, and my brother Kenneth, who's 22 months younger than I am. I'm the older of the two. And we had, you know, on Gray Street, you've heard me talk about it a lot,
right,
all coming up in the area. Down the street from me was my mom, my grandfather, and grandmom. Up the street was one of my grandmother's sisters. And on Madison Street, which was just over the hill, was another sister of my grandmother's. And then on Morrow was her third sister. Mm-hmm. So the Foster girls were all right there together. So it seems wherever I was in the neighborhood, it was always somebody looking at me. And if I did anything wrong, I would get, you know, spanking there. And sometimes I'd have to stop on the way. It was a relay spanking on the way home.
It takes a village, right?
But, you know, that's it. I grew up, and the good thing about it, I was in a home with good parents. You know, mom and dad, we lost dad in 13, but if he had lived 4 more months, he and mom would have celebrated their 70th wedding anniversary.
Wow.
So, but, you know, in the house, you know, I often tell people, I didn't realize we were poor until I got to college. Because, you know, we had our own home,
right,
where we lived. Dad worked 3 jobs for 10 years. Mom was always at home with us. She really didn't even work until we were in high school.
Right.
And she started then to help Dad put us through college.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I came up in a house, you know, where we had both parents. And they really were, they made sure their boys were successful in life.
Right.
We didn't appreciate them at the time, I don't think, as much as we do now.
Now that's true.
That we, and, you know, I tell the story, my birthday is in November. So when I was 5 years old, I couldn't get in the city schools. So at that time, we had, remember, it was segregated, everything.
Right, right.
And we had an all-black Catholic school, St. Anthony's, over on Walton Street. And it was first through the eighth grade. And all the nuns, it was nuns, Franciscans, most were, all were Irish, and most were from New York State. So that was interesting to have the nuns from New York. And
who were bringing a different perspective.
Different perspective from all. And I'll tell you, at the time, they were mean. And that's what way we looked at it. But they were really, you know, they demanded a lot out of us as students. Right. And you've heard me tell the story when I was in the seventh grade. I was taking algebra. I made, I remember it was 78 on an algebra test that Sister Mary Helen Trace gave us. Well, a friend of mine, Donald, made 74. She patted him on the back and said, good job, son. Mm-hmm. Keep up the good work. She told me, Alfred Whitesides, tell your parents you'll stay after school tomorrow because you're going to take the test over or another test. Well, after class, I asked her, I said, wait, why? You know, Donald made less than I did. She said, he's got nothing to do with it. She said, you didn't do the best that you can do. So I expect you to take it over. Well, the next afternoon, she was right after school. We were out then at 3. I had to take the test over, and it was not the same test. I think I made 90 on the test. You know what she told me? She said, that's more like it. She didn't say good or excellent. Right, right. I thought I'd done it. But that's the way they were. And I remember after leaving, when we had graduation cap and gowns and all. And when we graduated, I was valedictorian of the class. It wasn't but 8 of us, so it wasn't a lot. And I remember she told me, she said, now you'll do good in high school and college if you just stay focused. And remember, wait your turn with the girls until you get an education.
What a story. What a foundation. So Al, you have already sort of preempted the question that I was going to ask, which is about the educational dimension of that foundation. You talked about your schooling before attending Stevens Lee High School. Could you say a bit more about the educational foundation that you experienced here?
Well,
specifically with regard to Stevens Lee High School.
Well, let me tell you, before Stevens Lee even, my educational foundation started with Mom and Dad, because they always told us that what, and my grandfather really, he told us as boys, what you put between your ears, nobody can take away. That's what he told us. And Granddad always read, because he was a bellman at Grove Park Inn.
Right.
He always read the Wall Street Journal so he could, and Sporting News. So as a kid, I could read stock market, you know, deals like a grown man because of him. And I could tell you anything about baseball from the Sporting News. And later, though, I figured out why he read the Wall Street Journal. So he could talk to the customers.
The guests who were coming in.
The guests who would come in.
Right.
And he, you know, and that was so with that. And then when we would go to church at Sunday school, we had teachers, the black teachers in the church, who a lot of them taught at Stevens Lee High School.
Right.
They were teaching me in Sunday school as a kid. So they started telling me in an early age, when you go to college, and I always tell this, when I graduated from Stevens Lee, I knew I had to go to college to stay in Asheville or to come back home, because that was the expectation.
Right.
And
right.
They pushed us. You know, in Sunday school, we would have plays, we'd have to talk and all. And then when we went to Stevens Lee High, it was a different world, even from today.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I didn't realize until years later when I was on the school board reading some of the history of Asheville City Schools, back in the 40s, percentage-wise, Stevens Lee High School had more teachers with master's degrees than any high school in the state of North Carolina, black or white.
Yep.
Really?
And I went back and looked at my yearbook, what tells, you know, and sure enough, you can tell when you look at it. And they had master's degrees from, like, Columbia.
Right.
Yale, Indiana University, Michigan State. University of Chicago and all. And I found out in later years, you know, how they all, why they were at the top schools? They would go in the summer and get their master's
degrees.
But to keep them out of North Carolina State and Chapel Hill, state of North Carolina paid for it.
Wow.
But we had top-notch teachers,
right.
And that really paid off years later when I was in college, right. Too.
And yeah. I'm hearing, Alice, you're talking about this, that, you know, there were very high standards. I mean, it's interesting in your conversation talking about that there was an expectation that you were going to go to school. And, I mean, we could jump to it, it's to where we are now. Are those expectations still there? I mean, you talk about standards within your family that you had to, you were required to meet. It was an expectation that you would meet those standards, within the community, and definitely standards at school as well. And so I think that this is something important for us kind of to revisit sometimes. And I would be interested to hear your take on where we are today in the context of that, of those standards.
Because, you know, I volunteer a lot in schools today. Mm-hmm. I mentor boys at the middle school level. And what infuriates me is when I hear parents say that they're intimidated by the schools because they don't have an education. Mm-hmm. My dad, he says he went to the eighth grade. We never questioned him. But Mom did graduate from Stevens Lee.
Mm-hmm.
But all of them pushed us. Even my granddad and grandmom, they didn't go far in school. But they pushed us. Yeah. And they wanted to make sure that we had what they couldn't achieve at the time.
And I think it's so interesting to think of. You bring up your mentoring work. One of the things that I appreciate about what you're doing is you mentor a group of boys at Asheville Middle School, mm-hmm. which I think is so important. And I think that does kind of relate to where we wanted to talk about, because, you know, things have changed here in Asheville and Buncombe County over the course of your lifetime. And you were really right in the heart of that change. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about Stevens Lee, because you brought up the fact that you went to segregated schools at this time. Stevens Lee was one of those schools, which my parents went to school there,
sure.
as well. But during your time there, you were part of an effort to change the racial dynamic in the city. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences there?
Well, this started in, say, the late 50s. You had James Ferguson, mm-hmm. who's now is one of the top civil rights lawyers in the country. Marvin Chambers, mm-hmm. who still lives here. James in Charlotte. Marvin is in Asheville, retired engineer. And James Burton, who's a retired educator, he lives in upstate New York. You have Burnell Freeman, who's deceased, and Charles Bates, who's deceased. These five young men started ASCOR, Asheville Student Committee for Racial Equality. Mm-hmm. In Asheville. And what they did, ASCOR went on until 1965. And it was almost like a track meet because, you know, as kids would, as we would graduate from high school and move on, others would take our place.
That's right.
During that time, we desegregated the libraries, movie theaters. We couldn't even work as bag boys at A&P and Winn-Dixie. I was one of the first bag boys at A&P, and we even boycotted before, you know, we would go there. And we really didn't realize what we had accomplished, to be honest with you, until years later.
Right.
Because we were all graduating, leaving, and then, you know, others were picking up and going
mm-hmm.
on. And it was years later when we got back together and we realized, really, what we had accomplished as high school students.
Right.
Now, this was before going to college.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, and think about that. We did it in Asheville where you didn't have a black college.
Right. Mm. Right.
And so, you know, that's something, and we did it as students, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember on the line boycotting at Winn-Dixie, in front of the Winn-Dixie stores, which was where Bank of America is by the courthouse.
Right.
And a lot of days now when I pass there, I just laugh and think about the days. And I remember one Saturday morning, here I am walking the picket line. It was supposed to be four of us walking. Only two showed up. Of course, Mr. McCord, our advisor, he was standing there by his car. But it was just me and my brother. Now, you know how much confidence that is when you're walking a picket line with your little brother.
Right.
You know
that way.
But we had good. But I remember Dad, who was janitor at First National Bank then, and the president of the bank, we'd go up a lot and help him clean up so he could get home at a reasonable time. Well, we were cleaning up one night, dusting desks or doing something, and Mr. Parker, Charles Parker, who was president of First National Bank and also of Asheville Savings and Loan at the time, he was of both banks, which he couldn't do today. Well, he called me and my brother in his office. He closed the door, and we said, oh, good gracious, he's going to get on us about picketing, because I saw him pass by in his car that Saturday when we were out there. And he said, sit down. He said, you know, what you boys doing is the right thing. He said, but just keep it nonviolent. Don't let these knuckleheads sucker you into doing your. He went on and on. And then I remember when we were leaving, he said, went in his pocket and said, do you need any money for placards or anything? No, for posters or anything like that. Well, you know, being proud the way we were, we looked, no, sir. We walked out. And after we walked out, I remember my brother saying, we should have taken that old man's money. but we were too proud for that. We wouldn't.
Right.
But that said a lot, you know, when he realized, you know, the importance of what we were doing. Yeah. And a lot of the parents, though, were afraid to let their kids participate because, let's face it, when you look at the jobs that our parents had, a lot were domestic workers and all. They didn't know what would happen. They didn't want to lose their job.
That's right.
But, you know, that's something that my mom and dad never even discussed with us. They just told us the same thing. We don't want you to get hurt. Let it be nonviolent. And they said something else. Make sure you get your homework because it's no need of fighting to get in the door if you don't have it to stay there,
right,
education.
Now
think about it.
Yeah, right.
And they were that way even when we were in college, you know, the same thing.
Such an important story.
Yeah.
So before you go off to college, you know, you're doing this important work with the Asheville Student Committee on Racial Equality. You go off to college. We were talking before the show that you spent a couple years at my alma mater, Morehouse College.
Sure did.
Can you talk a bit about your experience in college and then coming back to Asheville after completing your college experience?
Okay. Now, let me give that was interesting. I go off in 1962 to Morehouse. How I ended up at Morehouse, you know, I was skeptical of going there because it was all boys' school. And remember what the nun told me?
Yes.
Yeah, she knew me well. Yeah. Well, I go off to Morehouse, and what was interesting, I knew my Uncle Thomas, which my great uncle, Thomas Kilgore, and the Kilgore Center, you know, at Morehouse is named after him. Well, when he worked his way through college, he worked his way through Morehouse. I knew that he stayed with a Baptist minister and his family, you know, and helped them with the kids when they traveled and all. But it was just another Baptist minister. But the Baptist minister was Martin Luther King Sr., you know, in Ebenezer Baptist Church. So in November of 1962, it was around my Thanksgiving, my birthday was around the 25th. We, of course, at Morehouse at the time, and me being a freshman, I didn't know any difference. I had an 8 o'clock class Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. That's when you don't know any better. Yeah, well, anyway, for Thanksgiving, we were only out in those days one day, Thanksgiving Day, so I couldn't come. That's right. I had classes on Friday and Saturday. Yeah, it's a different day then.
I'm just going to say right here, as I think about that.
Yeah.
Else I think about that as a professor. I'm glad we don't do
that. Yeah, be glad about
that.
Yeah. Well, what happened, though, was that Sunday, the Monday, they were having a board meeting at Morehouse. And my uncle, at that time, I think he had moved. He had just gone to Second Baptist in Los Angeles, so it was around the time. Anyway, he was coming in for board meeting, and he was preaching that Sunday at West Hunter Street Baptist Church, which was Ralph Abernathy's church.
That's right.
Okay. So Mom called me. And from home, and it was something when I saw a note to call home, you know what it was. And she said, your Uncle Thomas will be preaching at West Hunter, and he's expecting to see you at church. I said, oh, goodness, yeah. Now, I'd been there all this time. I'd been to church. You know, so I said, yes, ma'am. So I try to get my roommate to go with me. He wouldn't. He left me alone. So I go to West Hunter. He preached, and Reverend Abernathy told me, he said, well, after church, I got there early, he said, we'll take you out because your birthday, Tom was telling me it's your birthday, we'll take you out and get you a good meal. You won't get school, you know, whatever. So I said, okay. So after he finished the sermon and all, I was standing waiting on him, you know, there in the back of the church. And this nice man walked up, well-dressed, top coat on, and walked over to me, and he looked at me. He said, you must be a Kilgore, because you all look alike. You know, I laughed. I said, no, I'm on the white sides, but you're right. My mom is a Kilgore. He stuck his hand out and said, I'm Martin King.
You're right.
And at that time, Dr. King had just moved back to Atlanta with his dad.
Wow.
To, you know, at Ebenezer. And we talked, and he said, now, look, next Sunday, if I were you, I would be at Ebenezer. Tom told my mom that you were here, and she's been looking for you. And he said, she'll come to Graves Hall to get you, but you don't want that to happen.
Wow.
No, sir. So the next Sunday, I went
there
to Ebenezer. And what was funny about that, it was the old church, not the new church now. They had this usher. He looked like he was 8 feet tall, but he wasn't that tall, I don't think. You had to fill out a visitor's card before going to, you know, in church. My Lord, when I filled out the card, he looked, said, you're the boy we've been looking for. That was what he said. He walked me down the center aisle about to the second seat, said, you sit right there on the end. I said, yes, sir. He said, and don't move, because Mama King would like to see you when she finished, you know, playing
the
organ.
Right.
She played the organ. So she was playing the organ, and she looked back and smiled at me. You know, I was sitting there where, hey, if I had to go to the bathroom, I was in trouble because I was afraid to move. You know, he told me to stay there. Well, I stayed there. After it was over, I waited for her to change her robe and all. And Mrs. King came back. She came out, and she was just nice. She said, hold the robe. She gave me the book she had, and she was putting on a coat. And then she looked at me and said, where have you been?
Well, I tell
and,
you.
And it ended up, she took me to dinner after church with her. And from then on, when I was there, I went
you
to church,
there.
I was there because she could cook.
All right, well, this has been a great conversation.
Yeah,
and Marcus, what we're going to have to do, we're going to have to beg him to come back again to finish this, because I want to talk to him about coming back and about his time now as a commissioner. But I love hearing the story about his relationship with the King family. And Al, again, Marcus and I want to thank you for coming here and talking with us up to this point. And we want you to come back, please. So we hope you all have enjoyed just hearing this conversation. And Marcus and I want to remind you all again that the Waters and Harvest Show is produced at Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville, North Carolina.
And you can listen to our podcast on BPR.org, on the BPR mobile app, and on iTunes and Google Play.
Follow us and get in touch on Facebook and Twitter. Marcus, this has been a great conversation.
Great conversation. Talk to you next time.
Bye-bye.